Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Rachel Pagonis, and I'm your host for this episode. Today I'm speaking with Xiaoping Fang about his new book, China and the Cholera Pandemic, Restructuring Society Under Mao. Xiaoping Fang is Assistant Professor of History at the School of Humanities of the Nanyang Technological University, Singapore. His research interests focus on the history of medicine, health, and disease in 20th century China, and the socio-political history of Mao's China after 1949. He's also the author of Barefoot Doctors and Western Medicine in China, published by University of Rochester Press in 2012. And his articles have appeared in China Quarterly and Modern Asian Studies. Xiaoping Fang, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Rachel. Nice to meet you.
And likewise, I'm really excited to speak with you. As I've told you, I read your book, Barefoot Doctors and Western Medicine in China, and I found it really very interesting. And so is this book. But could you tell us a little bit about yourself first? Because I am speaking to you while you are in Singapore and I am in the US.
Okay. I was born and grew up in Zhejiang province, southeast coast of China. And after I got my MA degree from Nanjing University, I came to National University, Singapore, National University of Singapore. And I pursued my PhD in history there. And later, I went to UK, Australia. And last year, I visited the United States and came back to Singapore. And I'm teaching and working here. And I stay with my family here. That's my general background.
I see. And so that's interesting because I think you said you came from Zhejiang province. And I believe that's an area that figures in this book.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, your new book, China and the Cholera Pandemic, it seems very timely indeed. But I imagine that when you started researching it, you weren't thinking it would be published in the midst of the greatest pandemic in the last 100 years. So what interested you about this cholera pandemic in China in the 1960s?
Oh, yes, I have never imagined that I would have the direct personal experience of the pandemic when I wrote the book on the cholera pandemic over the past years. I started working on this project in 2011. But this topic came to my mind quite earlier. Just now I mentioned I was born and grew up in Zhejiang. In our childhood, we have heard of a name, the scary name or scary term called number two disease. Number two disease. Number two disease refers to the cholera pandemic in Mao's China. It's a scary disease. In 2003, I started working on my PhD dissertation about the Barefoot Doctors. So when I did the field work about the Barefoot Doctors, I went to the archives. So I found many archive documents concerning the the cholera in 1960s. Some documents. But after I finished revising my dissertation into a book, so I started working on the cholera pandemic. So that was around 10 years ago.
So a long time in the making. And the cholera pandemic that you write about actually started in a place called Guangdong Province.
Yes.
In June 1961. But you chose to focus on the epidemic in Wenzhou Prefecture. And that started about a year later. So what was it about this particular area that made you decide to focus on it?
Well, I centered my study on Wenzhou Prefecture simply because the incident rate of the cholera in Wenzhou Prefecture, Zhejiang Province, was the highest in the coastal areas of China in early 1960s. And Wenzhou happens to be a part of the Zhejiang Province where I'm from. And it is relatively easy for me to conduct the field work, including the visiting the archives, interviewing the local villages. So the two reasons. The one is the instance rate of the cholera in Wenzhou Prefecture was the highest in the southeast coast areas of China. The second, I happen to come from Zhejiang Province, and Wenzhou is part of Zhejiang Province. It is easy to conduct the field work.
Yeah, okay, so that's interesting. Maybe part of it has to do with that was you had grown up with this knowledge of the number two disease, and we can talk about that later, why it's called number two disease. You write in the introduction that there are three main areas that you focus on, disease and mobility, social division and borders, and data and social structure. So I'd like to talk about all of those. But just in terms of why the incidence rate was highest in this coastal area, you talk about the sedentary rural society versus the mobile coastal society. Could you explain what that difference is and why it was?
Oh, yes. In my book, I talk about the two types of the population mobilities in Mao's China, particularly during the early 1960s. We usually describe the population mobility in Mao's China as the static society because of the social structures composing of the household registration system in the household registration system and the work unit systems. But there was a transitional period from the chaotic population mobility to the static population mobility from the late 1950s to early 1960s. As we know, the Chinese government launched the Great Leap Forward and organized the People's Commune system in 1958. So around these two radical social political experiments, the population mobility was quite chaotic. I mean, it was not highly coordinated and supervised by the government. But after the end of the Great Leap Forward and the Great Famine around 1961 and 1962, the government restructured the social political system. So the population mobility shifted from the chaotic mobility to the relatively sedentary mobility. I mean, chaotic to the sedentary. I mean, the population mobility was highly monitored and supervised by the government and the party. So that's the first concept, the sedentary, the society. That's the one point. On the other hand, I also proposed the term, the mobile coastal front society, because in early 1960s, when the Chinese government and the party reorganized or restructured social political system, the whole system became static. There were a minimum of three mobile groups in the coastal areas of China, such as the People's Liberation Armies and the visitors, overseas visitors, such as the visitors from Southeast Asia, like Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, and the visitor from Hong Kong. And then the third mobile group was the fishermen from Guangdong province. So the three mobile groups, the People's Liberation Armies, the overseas visitors, and the fishermen from Guangdong or Fujian province. So they, this, the mobility of these people formed a mobile coastal front society.
And as you write, that this very mobility allowed this to be an area where the epidemic could spread more rapidly. But at the same time, it didn't spread evenly across all sectors of society.
Yes.
For instance, the People's Liberation Army, they were much better off than some of the villagers.
Yeah, because of the, yes, in my book, I analyzed the instance rates between incident rates of the People's Liberation Army soldiers and the civilians in the same areas. I mean, in the southeast coast area of China. For the People's Liberation Armies, they had the much better the food supply and the medical care the schemes and the other guarantee other supports. So the incidence rates among the People's Liberation soldiers was the lowest compared with other social groups. But for the peasants, they just survived the great farming, and the whole system was restructured, and they have to support the so-called the anti reclaim the mainland campaign launched by the Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan. So there was the huge difference in terms of the incident rates of the cholera in early 1960s.
And as you write, there was also some interesting changes in the way the cholera spread amongst the different sexes, because women previously had been more isolated at home, and now women were liberated, which meant they were actually mandated, I think, to go work in the fields in agriculture, and that exposed them to cholera. So women began contracting this epidemic disease more than they had in previous cholera epidemics. Is that right?
Yes. That was a very significant part of the cholera pandemic in early 1960s. As you mentioned just now, the women Chinese women usually did not participate in agriculture production in some parts of China. So in South China, in some parts of the southeast coast China, at least in Wenzhou Prefecture, many women did not participate in agricultural productions before 1949. But after the mid 1950s, the government launched the agriculture collectivization campaigns, and the women were so-called liberated by the government, and they were encouraged to participate in the production. Particularly, they went to the rice paddy fields, and they exposed the water, contaminated water, and they suffered the cholera pandemic. So the incident rate of the cholera among the Chinese women after 1949 was much higher than that in before 1949. Yeah, that was the comparative conclusion.
Yeah, so really interesting epidemiology there. And because this book is not only about the cholera pandemic, but it's about the restructuring of society under Mao and how those two things work together, could you just explain a little bit about the three systems that form the socio-political structure in Mao's China, that the household registration system and the work unit system and the people's commune system?
Okay. Yes. In Mao's China from 1949 to 1978, there were three crucial socio-political systems. The one is the household registration system. The second is the work unit system. We call the Danwei system. And the third is the people's commune system. Regarding the household registration system, it was implemented since 1958. And this system split the Chinese populations into two types of the populations. One refers to the agricultural populations, peasants or people's commune members, and the other refer to the non-agricultural populations, generally refer to urban residents. And in this system was described as the castle hierarchical system based on the identity of the populations. So because agricultural population, I mean the peasants were abolished of the basic social political welfare such as education, Medicare, and the mobility, the free mobility, the right or freedom of the mobility. But urban residents, those people affiliated the working units could enjoy a series of the social political welfares. So it was described as the castle-like hierarchical system based on the identities of the population. And the work units, work unit systems is affiliated with the urban population or the urban residents. It is included government agencies, state-owned enterprises, the schools like the university, middle schools or primary schools, and other government agencies. So that was the important social political system implemented in Mao's China. And the third is the people's commune system. I think the audience might be more familiar with the people's commune system than the two previous the systems, the people's commune system. That was the very radical social political experience launched by Mao in late 1950s, and just after the agricultural collectivization campaign in mid 1950s. So the people's commune system was implemented since 1958, but it was the quite too radical. And we know this radical social political experiment resulted in a catastrophic great famine from 1959 to 1961. And after 1961, the government and the party restructure the people's commune systems from 1962 to 1965, the period my book discussed. So this social restructuring was very significant for Mao's China, for the transitional period of Mao's China. So this pandemic happened to break out and spread from 1962 to 1965, when the government was launching the radical social political restructuring campaign. So these are the three social political system in Mao's China.
So yeah, and that's part of the background of how the government had a certain means of controlling the epidemic as well. But yeah, then control measures for the epidemic also contributed to that social restructuring, didn't they?
Yes, yes. It was a reciprocal process. On the one hand, the social political restructuring society, social political restructuring campaign contributed to the control of the cholera pandemic. On the other hand, the measures adopted by the anti-cholera campaign contributed to the social political restructuring campaign during the same time.
Yes, and the anti-cholera campaign. So I'm just going to jump ahead a little bit here to chapter five, because this is about inoculation. Chapter five is called A Comprehensive Inoculation, Rural Rhythms and Compiling Registers. And this may also be of interest to people now because we have a big matter of vaccinating the population against coronavirus. But the government went to a tremendous amount of trouble to conduct a mass vaccination of a campaign. And, you know, you go into it in a lot of detail. At the end of the chapter, we learned that that campaign was largely unsuccessful in controlling cholera. You even mentioned, so as the campaign was being carried out, there was evidence within China and internationally as well. The WHO made notice that vaccinating against cholera was not particularly effective. And you even mentioned an epidemiologist at a Ministry of Health symposium in 1963, so this was in the middle of the pandemic, yes, and he stated, the data we collected on the ground provided no evidence that preventive inoculation was effective in preventing cholera. But you state, anyway, and I'm quoting here, the cholera inoculation campaigns in the early 1960s were a significant social and political exercise rather than merely an episode in the medical and public health history of China. Can you explain what the significance of that was then?
Okay. Just now I mentioned the second system, the third system, the People's Commune system. The People's Commune system was implemented in 1958. By 1961, this system was collapsed. And it resulted in the Great Famine. So around 1961 and 1962, the government started restructuring the People's Commune system. There were many steps and many measures. First of all, the government intended to control and manage the People's Commune system more effectively than before. Then the system implemented in 1958 to 1962. So one of the crucial steps adopted by the party and the government was to reduce the size of the People's Commune system. I mean, from 1958 to 1962, the size of the commune system was too big to be managed effectively. So now the government reduced the size of the People's Commune. So, I mean, the People's Commune system was composed of the commune production brigade and the production teams. So reduce the size. That was the crucial step. And the second, redesigned the roles for the ruler official, the ruler cadres, for the ruler cadres of the production brigades and the production teams. For example, production brigades, the party secretary and the production brigades directors at the production level. And those production directors and the production team's accountants and the production's work point recorders at the production team levels. So all the cadres have their particular roles and functions within the newly restructured systems. So this second step contribute to the effective management of the rural areas. So that was very significant. And so let's come back to the comprehensive inoculation. So as I mentioned in my book, the comprehensive inoculation completely depended on the coordinations between the local administrative system and medical systems. So this local administrative system refers to the people or the rural cadres of the production brigade and production teams. And for the medical system refers to the medical professionals, healthcare workers. These people come from urban areas, and some of them even come from the other prefectures within the same province, and even from the different province. So how to coordinate this large scale inoculation campaign was very important, and it depends on the coordination of the two systems. But in my book, I discuss through how the government and how the inoculation campaign contributes through the contribution to the social political restructuring campaigns. For example, in the local administrative systems, all the production brigade and the production teams the cadres participated in the inoculation campaigns, and the population data in the household registration certificate and the work points the manuals were highly and repeatedly verified. So does that make sense?
Yes. So I was really impressed by the tremendous amount of information that was available on everybody, and how everybody was documented, and inoculation certificates were required, and they had to do that based on the household registration system, right? Rather than the existing system of through the production brigades.
Yeah.
And there was some resistance to inoculation too. There was some considerable resistance. In fact, there were even some physical fights at checkpoints along the road where people were supposed to present evidence of inoculation. Is that right?
Yes. That happened at some the quarantine and isolation at the stations. But it particularly happened among the social political groups with some privileges, like the soldiers and the government officials, and particularly two groups.
And they were the ones who didn't want to get inoculated, right? The ones with more privilege resisted?
No, I don't think so. I have not read the archived document concerning the resistance of the inoculation among the government officials and People's Liberation Armies. But some of the archived document did indicate there was the irregular resistance against the quarantine at the quarantine and isolation stations.
Oh, that's right. I must have misremembered. It was the resistance against the quarantine.
Yeah, because the inoculation was compulsory.
Right. Right. And they wanted, in the beginning, they had thought that they needed to inoculate 80% of the population.
Yes.
For herd immunity. But then later, I believe it was 95%, wasn't it?
The much higher, around 90%. It depends on depended on the locations.
Yeah. And so along with the inoculation campaign, of course, you have another section on data collection and stools. In fact, they collected a lot of data. I mean, this chapter is labeled stool samples, archiving patients and statistical politics. So there were a lot of stool samples taken because I guess two things in cholera, there's a lot of diarrhea and that's where you can detect the disease. So the kind of testing that was done was on stool samples. But you also talk a lot about the use of statistics and how it's used epidemiologically, but also how statistics were used politically. And statistics were tied up on all kinds of non-epidemiological uses, such as showing party loyalty or improving the image of China under communist rule. One thing that really struck me was when you described how the People's Daily, which was the mouthpiece of the party, published only one media report on the entire cholera pandemic in mainland China from 1961 to 1965. Can you talk a little bit about the purpose and the effect of that level of media control?
Oh, yes, that happened. That happened in 1961 to 1965. It is very significant, and it is also very sensitive. In my book, I discuss the why the government and the party controlled information over the cholera pandemic in early 1960s. So they had a few concerns, such as the social political images of the socialist country and the party, because the disease like the cholera plague were usually associated with the old society, old regime, or old the nationalist the parties. So the first concern is the social political images of the country and the party. And the second is the economic concerns. I have not discussed it in depth. I mean the social economic concern about the information of the pandemic. And the third is the social order. That because in imperial China, the collective response to the pandemic was usually the religious ceremony, or just the fled from the city or the villages. All these collective response was believed or described to result in the social disorder. So that was very, very significant for the Chinese government and the parties around 1961 and 1962. As I mentioned, in these two years, the Great Leap Forward just ended, and the Great Famine was still lingering. So very sensitive timing for the government and for the party. So that's why the government wanted to control the information during that period.
And you also describe varying levels of secrecy that was used to classify information about the pandemic. I mean, I think they had three levels of secrecy.
Yes.
But they were all quite secret. And only certain kinds of information could be divulged to the masses, whereas other kinds of information might be revealed to cadres or other people higher up in the party. And they use something called the five mentions and the five non-mentions. Could you describe what those are?
Okay. The five mentions, the purpose, oh yeah, I forgot to answer your question about the significance of the people's daily, the mouthpiece of the government and the party's publicity, the scheme. Yes, the publicity scheme or the propaganda schemes of the government and the party was very effective. But because all the information in the medias was managed and controlled by the government and the parties. So among all these medias, People's Daily was the most significant one, and they distribute they released information. For example, during the pandemic, there was only one report concerning the cholera epidemic in Yangjiang County, Guangdong Province in 1961. And all the other medias at the provincial, prefectural, or the county level just followed the central media's direction. So that was very significant. And so what's your the question?
Oh, I was asking you about the five mentions and non-mentions.
Okay, five mentions. Yeah, the purpose of the five governments, because the government, I just now mentioned, the government wanted to control the pandemic information in early 1960s, and there were many reasons. One of the concerns was the social political images of the party and the government. So the party and the government also took this opportunity to show the political legitimacy of the party and the government, and that they, for example, comparing the measures and the efforts by the nationalist government and the communist government. So five mentions. Let me take a look. Five mentions. So which page should we?
Oh gosh.
Let me take a look. Oh yeah, I find it. So yes, publicity. It is on the pages 215, 216. So publicity campaigns about the cholera follow the principle of five mentions and five non-mentions. In Chinese, we call the wu jiang. So the five mentions were publicizing high incidence rates and the mortality rates in Taiwan. So Taiwan belonged to the Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government in 1960s. And publicizing high fatality rates in Southeast Asian countries, such as India, Indonesia, and Hong Kong. And the third is publicizing the fact that all the Chinese government did not care about the people's health before liberation. And the fourth is publicizing the advantages of the preventive inoculation. And the fifth is only publicizing information on the infectious intestinal disease in China, why not mention the cholera. The five non-mentions refer to actively not mention the epidemic situation in the country as a whole, in any province, county, or community, or in text posters and other printed materials. So generally speaking, the principle of the five mentions and the five non-mentions was to justify and show the political legitimacies of the government and the parties in the 1960s.
I wonder, because when I read that, and there was another place where you said that people who had the information were instructed not to broadcast it over wireless systems also. Mm. And it did remind me a little bit of the way information about the coronavirus was handled in the United States last year. Mm. And I wonder, do you see similar efforts to control the flow of information about the current coronavirus pandemic in China?
It's a difficult question because I am a historian of the pandemic in Mao's China.
Right.
I did not find the evidence that the government intentionally controlled information. At least it is quite different from the response to the SARS in 2003. I mean, the response to the comparing the response to the SARS in 2003 and the coronavirus, the COVID-19 in 2020, we found that the government response to the coronavirus was more quickly, but the info for the informations, I think it's quite difficult to answer. Yeah.
Yes, I understand, and I think it's probably difficult to answer for any country as well. I apologize. It's just the kind of thing that came to mind because you can't help but think from one pandemic to another. Something I wanted to actually go back, because there's something very interesting also about the way the medical system was operating in China, because there was a rather complicated, I would say, medical system. At the time, you had the urban doctors, but you also had, and you had some urban doctors who were sent to the rural areas.
Yes.
Because there was at this time a focus on the rural areas. And you also had some traditional Chinese medicine doctors.
Yes.
Who got involved in the inoculation campaign as well. But and I think you mentioned too that at one point in some communes, they actually had decided that medical work was not important because it was more important for people to be doing agricultural work.
Oh, yes.
So,
that happened before the outbreak of the cholera pandemic in 1962. Because, that happened. In 1961, 1962, the people's commune, the older people's commune system collapsed, and the great farming was still lingering. So the agriculture production was more important than the normal or routine epidemic preventions. In the views of some production brigade and production teams, cadres. But that happened before the outbreak of the pandemic. And it also happened among some, in some people's communes to some extent. So it happened. Yeah.
Yes. And then as far as the, how to say, because I have a particular interest in Chinese medicine doctors, traditional Chinese medicine doctors, And they had some opportunities actually in this pandemic as well. Can you explain what that was?
Oh yes, they played a very important roles in the anti-cholera pandemic in early 1960s. So as we know, the traditional Chinese medical practitioners were the only available medical professionals in rural areas to great extent. In early 1960s, there were not that many Western medicine practitioners in rural areas back in early 1960s. So they were mobilized to participate in the anti-cholera the campaign on a large scale. On the one hand, they were asked to assist the medical professionals from the urban areas in terms of inoculation and the preparation of the inoculation certificates and all the filling the inoculation certificates. On the other hand, some Chinese medical practitioners were encouraged to cooperate with the Western medicine practitioner to develop some recipes for the cholera patients, such as prepare the Chinese medicine decoctions and develop the Chinese acupuncture skills to treat the cholera patients. But to some extent, these measures, there's a cooperative measures between the Chinese and the Western medical practitioners was not as was not effective as expected. I mean, the government encouraged them to cooperate to develop the Chinese medicine, the treatment methods, and acupuncture, the skills. But these measures was not so effective as the government expected. But these measures were still used after the conditions of the cholera patients were stable. I mean, stabilized.
To help them improve it, I think you mentioned, you wrote about how it was difficult because the two main approaches that the traditional Chinese medicine doctors would take was giving herbal formulas and made from herbs, and sometimes those don't taste very good and they can even upset the stomach. And the other was using acupuncture. As you said, it was hard for them to keep the herbal decoction down. Sometimes they would vomit it back up, and the acupuncture was just hard to do on people who were in poor shape. So that was interesting. I know what else I wanted to ask you about, because this particular pandemic that you focus on lasted until 1965, but then there were other cholera epidemics that broke out at various times in China since then. And what was the approach after that? Because you mentioned a little bit, the WHO, I think it was in 1978, was it, that they decided that inoculation wasn't the best way forward?
That's a good questions. Yeah, I focused on the cholera in 1961 to 1965. In my book, I also mentioned from 1965 to 1977, there were not so many cholera cases. But after 1978, broke out again in some areas of the coast, the southeast coast part of China. The government from 1978 to early 1980s, the government still used the traditional interventionist prevention methods such as inoculation, quarantine and isolations. But after the early 1980s, the government did not adopt these traditional measures, because for the government, for the medical systems, it was relatively easier to manage the outbreak of the cholera pandemic than before. I mean, relatively easier. For example, the supply of the medicine for treating the cholera pandemic, for the managing the isolation of the infected cholera patients, it was relatively easy. It was not a problem for the government and for the medical system.
Yeah, something that we didn't really cover before was how very isolated some areas were that were in mountainous regions, and the people who were going to help them came from the urban areas and had never had experience walking through dark mountain roads at night, as you said.
Oh yeah. In most China, it was easier to control and monitor the population mobility from rural areas to urban areas, and it correspondingly contributed to the effective monitoring of the cholera patients. But after 1978, it will be more difficult to control the population mobilities, but it was not a problem for the governments and the medical system to identify the cholera patients.
Yes, another thing that struck me reading this book was how very much data was collected, meticulously collected, and how much more difficult that would have been in the early 1960s. In the mid 1960s than it is today.
It's a good question. Yeah, the statistic politics is a part of this book. the key themes. The government, yes, government did make a great effort to establish both the administrative system and the medical system to collect the data. I mean, this data, including the social political data, such as household registrations, and they also refer to the economic data, such as the work point menus held by the people's commune. It also refer to the epidemiological data, such as the data concerning the various disease and infection disease among the Chinese population. It was very significant to establish and implement this data collection system.
Yes, and as you say, that had a significant effect on the restructuring of society through having that information.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, different types of the data integrates, and they are repeatedly verified. I mean, this data was checked. The accuracy of this data was checked by the different other types of the data.
Yes, it seems like a tremendous effort.
Yes.
Well, Xiaoping, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, I wanted to ask you one last question, which is, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm still thinking which topic I will be working on. I want to take a break and write a few articles before I find an ideal topic, book project topic.
Well, this one took many years, as you said.
Oh, yes. So, I started working on this project in 2011 and completed last year. So around 10 years. So
yeah, so
cautious.
I can see.
Should be cautious with the topic of the book project.
That's right.
I take time to identify and discuss with my colleagues and friends and seek their suggestion, which topic will be of interest to you. So, and then I should start to working on the new project, book project.
Yes, if you're going to devote the next 10 years of your life to it, you want to be sure. Well, Xiaoping, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. I learned so much from reading this book, and I would say to anyone who's interested in epidemics or the social structure of China during this period of Mao's restructuring. The book is what people refer to as a granular reporting. It just goes into a great level of detail that is just magnificent to understand exactly how things are taking place on all these different levels. And I feel like I've looked at this area of China with a microscope and been able to see it so much more clearly during this particular period. So an impressive work, and it really has been a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, thank you. It's my great pleasure. And thank you for your time.